Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain. Ordinarily, I say this is my opportunity to step away from the worlds of politics and law that you watch me cover on television every day. And I usually say we enter the world of theater and the arts. Well, we're not going to quite do that today, although arguably politics is theater. But and arguably this particular person we're going to talk about is theater. But we're going to stay in the world of politics most clearly. And my guest is Ken Block. Now, you may have seen me interview him on our WGN Midday News. You're welcome to go online, watch that interview and from the Midday Fix segments, but we get more time because we hardly have any time on television to talk more about it here. And Ken's book, doing very well, I might say, is Disproven, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the Data That Shows Why He Lost and how We Can Improve Our Elections. I would have guessed you were a lawyer with a book titled that long.
I'm told it's a record in terms of the length of the subtitle.
Yeah, very good subtitle. But so you are the guy that the Trump campaign came to said, find the fraud in the voting. We all lived through it. The book Disproven title suggests that you didn't find that. Let's just put that out there as an open comment. Why were you the guy the Trump team came to? And especially in the end, you didn't give them what they were looking for. Not happy with you.
Well, so they never expressed that discontent. So let's get that out of the way up front. I was engaged by a top attorney to the Trump campaign, a full-time employee of the campaign, who was interested in a straight-up assessment of whether or not voter fraud impacted the 2020 election. He set me up. His name was Alex Cannon. And he set me up with a framework under which we did this work where my company's identity and my identity were not made known to people above him in the campaign and in the White House, specifically to keep political pressures away from the work that I was being asked to produce. And that work was of two pieces. I was asked to produce my own evidence, if it was there, of voter fraud in terms of deceased voters or people who voted twice in two different states. And that was what I was my original contract asked me to do. But then the day after I started working, Alex began delivering to me claims of voter fraud that came to him from all over the country. And where those claims had a foundation in data, he asked me to try to determine whether the claims were true or false. And in every circumstance, those claims were false.
Let's get one thing out of the way because and then I'm going to set you up for something that I'll let you know about. But anyway, so the question out of the way, a lot of people think, well, sure, because he's probably a never Trumper and, probably some liberal Democrat that they brought in. Of course, he found that there was no fraud. What party do you see yourself affiliated with and who did you vote for in 2016 and 2020?
Yeah, so I've been registered as a Republican since 2013. And in my home state of Rhode Island, where I've run for governor twice, if you want to challenge the political status quo here and you want to make changes in government, you can't do so from within the Democratic Party. And I'm the kind of guy who likes to try to make things better. And the only way to affect change here is registered as a Republican. And that's where I've been. And that's where I remain today. I'm fiscally conservative and socially I'm libertarian, leave everybody alone type thing. So that's kind of where I come from. I do not discuss who I voted for and why. That's private information. And as somebody who has run for office and I have no plans currently, but I might run for office down the road, starting to talk about things about who you voted for is a losing proposition across the board. And since 2013, I've just had a policy where I just don't talk about who I voted for. Nothing good comes of it.
So, well, I'm not going to fight you on that. I get it. But I will do one follow-up to it, which is for most people, and even you in most cases, I'd say, well, of course, somebody said to me, who'd you vote for? I'm a neutral analyst on the air. I can't, I vote for everybody. or nobody. But here's the thing. This is the setup part of the question.
Yeah.
After we did our television interview, I started getting comments. Now, some were very nice comments, of course, but that's not what I'm going to ask you about. You don't need to hear the good stuff. But there were other people who started, and actually, if you saw it on Twitter, people who, of course, had their own evidence and their own research and everything else to show why everything you were sharing, it was wrong, it was whatever, you're paid for it, all the kind of stuff you would, I know you get as well. It's got to be, I have a couple of copies of your book, you know, buy one, get one free. And so I gave one to a friend of mine who's a very strong Trumper who just, whatever Trump does, and I said, well, I want you to read this book. And he did, and I ran into him the other day. And of course, he said he had to stop reading after a few chapters because he was on page 5 of taking his own notes on everything and started having questions. I mean, he picked up reading, but at that point, I had to take a break, he said, because I had issues with this and I had issues with that. Now, this guy doesn't really know anything official. So my question to you is, given the negative, the reason I'm going back to the who did you vote for, if you tell me you voted for Trump and won both of those elections, then I'd say, well, then this has to be a true unbiased thing. If you say, oh, I'm a big Biden supporter and I love Hillary and go to lunch with her daily, then that would suggest that maybe we should raise questions about the book. So that's why I'm asking, not because I actually care.
Yeah. I'm going to answer your question a little bit differently than what you're asking me to deliver to you. And right. I am an expert in voter data. I have been developing that expertise over a decade. I have helped identify in states like Pennsylvania, where election officials failed to remove 20,000 deceased registered voters from the voter rolls. My data has helped inform lawsuits that have questioned how states are doing their work. And my data has also helped states defend themselves from lawsuits where others have brought lawsuits challenging how the states conduct their elections. I am a professional. I have done really big, important projects across the country. I've developed the country's first online food stamp debit card system. We replaced paper-based food stamps back in the mid-1990s for the state of Texas. And I had a personal role in helping the state save over $1 billion of waste and fraud in that program. When I
don't hear too much far away from that question, though.
Right. Well, so I'm just laying the groundwork for where I come from. And I was hired professionally to deliver results that would survive legal scrutiny in court that informed a lawsuit brought by the Trump campaign contesting an election result. And what I just said is such a high bar that I can assure you that anybody who's yelling on Twitter or anywhere else about, well, he didn't look into the bamboo shoots in the ballots in Arizona, or
that's what I'm talking about.
What about those ballots in a ditch or Ruby Freeman's USB key? All of this stuff can't possibly rise to the level of evidence necessary to survive legal scrutiny in court. And that's why you see lawyers like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, and John Eastman, who are being professionally censored for the shoddy work they did, the lack of due diligence that they conducted when they just flung these lawsuits willy-nilly all over the place. I am the serious guy that you bring on board to make sure that your lawsuit is going to survive and win in court. And anybody who questions my ability to do that work in a balanced, professional, and most importantly, responsible way has no idea what they're talking about. And all of the evidence that they prefer to believe is actual proof of voter fraud is nothing of the sort. It's hearsay evidence. It is somebody said they saw something, or worse, it's something that's already been thoroughly debunked, but they still hang on to it as if it's still true today, or they'll trot out 2,000 mules or whatever. And we've seen this kind of evidence across the board be debunked. The 2,000 mules lawyers in a lawsuit in Georgia, when pressed to provide the evidence that underpinned everything about that book, were forced to say, we don't have it.
Right. So if people don't know what 2,000 mules is, go look up Dinesh D'Souza and you'll find out everything you need to know.
Right, right. So I basically reject the premise of the idea that if I'm not voting for somebody or whatever, that means that there's no way for me to conduct the work that I did professionally, responsibly, and to the letter of what the contract required me to do. And that's why I don't answer the question, because it actually really doesn't matter.
Right. But I'm here to ask the questions that you know people want to know.
No problem.
And let me do one other angle. Here's where I might be different than a lot of interviews you've had, because I've got a doctorate in communication. I get the statistics stuff. I get the numbers. I've taught statistics at a graduate level. So I ask this from experience. There are people who say people can make numbers look any way you want. Give me the data. Tell me what you need. And I can play with these, not even in an unethical way. I can present them by giving certain interpretations that will give you the conclusions you want. So having said that, I think what you're saying is, even if you had run the Trump campaign in 2016 and 2020, you were the head guy, this book would have come out the way it did.
Yes, absolutely. Because the framing of everything that I did and every question, every time I was asked to assess a claim, I was taking on the role of the expert who in court would try to tear that claim to pieces. And honestly, it wasn't hard to destroy every single one of these claims. They were some of them were so absolutely bonkers and just wrong from the word go, because the person who did the analysis made crucial mistakes right at the beginning of the process. These weren't serious claims. And remember, I'm talking to some pretty high-powered lawyers who were controlling me and providing me the work that I did. And they understood the truth of every single thing that I delivered to them, to the point when they had to summarize the campaign's efforts to Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff at the time. They told him, we looked hard for evidence of voter fraud, and we evaluated every claim of voter fraud that got sent to us. They were all wrong. We have the proof for why they were wrong across the board. It just simply wasn't there. And Mark Meadows himself accepted that statement as true. So this isn't just me being evil and gumming up the works, right? It has nothing like that at all. This was a serious, serious look. I have a serious professional reputation. I have a serious personal reputation. I have run for governor, and I have customers and clients who I can't afford to be seen making colossally idiotic mistakes in the work that I did. So it's all buttoned up. It's all by the books. And every single thing I delivered came attached with all the proof. And anybody who wants to can work their way through the proofs the same way I did, and they'll reach the same conclusions
I did. And of course, sometimes, I mean, not too long ago, we had Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and former President Trump doing a press conference in Mar-a-Lago where they talked about the importance of not letting undocumented immigrants or migrants vote. We have a law on the books that doesn't allow that. The point is, if you're not an educated person, you're going to hear things, and you heard it all the way through yours because you knew all this data. So when you're hearing all of the 2,000 mules and the Ruby Freeman is passing ISB ports, and I mean, you look and going, this is crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy. You know, and that press conference, you know, was just this past Friday. And I see it as a major missed opportunity for President Trump to have really grabbed a hold of the national conversation and talked about some of the things that we really need to do to improve our election integrity, that there's agreement on both sides and we can get some compromise done. And he could have been the leading voice for driving for some of these changes that we really need to be making right now. So I found the whole press conference discouraging. And ultimately, it was political theater and really didn't have anything to do with fixing election integrity.
But one of the things I think you have to wrestle with in related to that question is, look, the stories we got, look, you were dealing with two sets of lawyers. You write about this in the book. There's the, you know, I have a lawyer background. So there's the partners and associates in the law firm mental state, which is its own thing. And then you're dealing with Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. That's another whole thing. And they're very different things. So my point is this. The problem for you is that you're sitting here dealing with numbers and graphs. And they're in the book. We see numbers and graphs and charts in the book, and you're explaining it. But you're up against, from a public sphere, the Rudy Giuliani stories that are out there. And I'm going to be honest, Ken, Rudy's stories are much more interesting than statistics and graphs.
Yeah. Well, I would argue the 700,000 duplicate voters in Wisconsin is a pretty entertaining story all on its own, and fundamentally one that was wrong from the start.
Don't let that get in your way.
Yeah. No. I understand it. And look, you know, Rudy Giuliani admitted he lied about Ruby Freeman, and the 2,000 Mules lawyers admitted there was no underlying data that supported the story that 2,000 Mules was spinning. And even for speaking,
mules, by the way, are people. I think people that we can't assume already. Mules are not the animal mules; they're people.
Right, they are people delivering ballots. And ballot harvesting on its own, in my opinion, is a terrible practice, and we should get rid of it. But let's not develop made up stories about what ballot harvesting harms are being done, because you hurt everybody's ability to actually maybe get rid of the darn thing. But you know, for me, with Rudy, with Giuliani, with Sidney Powell, who admitted her own claims in her filed lawsuits were garbage. My word, not hers, right? We are in a place right now where people are willing to believe the unbelievable because it fits with what their worldview wants to be, as opposed to thinking about it critically and being able to say, well, if someone's saying that there were 700,000 bad votes somewhere, maybe they did something wrong, right? It's the critical thinking aspect of it that is lacking in a great many of these situations at this point. And look, these lawyers, the reckless lawyers, were sniping at the careful lawyers throughout the time that I did this work. I didn't know it at the time, but the January 6th deposition transcripts describe it in pretty gory detail. Yeah. And, you know, there were two different basic needs that were fundamentally different from each other that the different groups of lawyers were working on. The reckless lawyers were about the politics of it. And the careful lawyers were about the legally making sure we're buttoned up. And if we go to court, we win. And those are two dramatically different things. All of these claims, the hearsay claims, every single claim that Sidney Powell filed, that Cleta Mitchell filed, that Rudy Giuliani filed, that John Eastman filed, they were about the political theater of the filing itself. And I don't think for a minute they thought they'd prevail in court. That wasn't what they were aiming to do.
Yeah, it astounded me. I mean, of course, John Eastman has lost his law license. He'll appeal. We'll see what happens. But I was personally astounded. I'm not going to turn you into a lawyer on this, but that Sidney Powell did not, for whatever reasons the Texas Supreme Court had, they found that she did what she did, which was really among the top of the craziness, didn't lose her license. That comment, for people watching who are Trump supporters, that is not an anti-Trump comment. That is a be a good lawyer comment. But that's aside. But, you know, one of the most important statements that you write in the book. I mean, you could almost have just had the book and this put, this is the title. An unsubstantiated claim of fraud is not a credible case of fraud. I just think that's one of the most powerful things you wrote in the book. It says it all.
Yeah. It's at the core of every single claim that I was asked to evaluate. It has turned out to be the answer to the claims of hearsay that have been torn apart one after the other, after the other, after the other. I mean, just today on X, someone was I had done an interview, a TV interview in one of the swing states, and somebody had come and onto my come at me on X and basically said, well, you know, we have all these cities where there were more votes cast than there were registered voters. And my immediate response to that was, tell me which one. And there was no answer, right?
No, you don't get answers to that.
Right. So it's so important to separate the theater from the reality. And it's actually, I really wish that attacks on our election infrastructure wasn't the most important political theater that candidates think that needs to be engaged in right now. But it's obviously not going to stop, and we'll continue this way through the election. We have to pull out the other side, and we do need to make some very necessary changes to how we do our elections. We still conduct them largely as we did 200 years ago.
Well, I want to step in there, because we're going to talk about that. So I apologize for doing that, but we're going to get there.
Okay,
that's
great.
The advantage of the podcast, unlike the television, the 7 minutes that you get on TV in an interview. So far, we've been talking about the kind of things you've been addressing over and over again on every station in the country.
Yep.
So let's talk about what you haven't had time to address, because TV doesn't permit it. There are three parts to your book. The first part of the book, which is what you have to focus on everywhere you go, is the work you did for Trump. What you never get to talk about, as far as I can see, are the second and third parts of the book. Although we did tap into it a little bit on TV, because I wanted to be fair to you. But anyway, the second part of your book, essentially, you write about how 50 states have the same job to do when it comes to elections, and how so many can do it differently from each other, and yet all of them in many ways leading to chaos.
Yes.
Talk about that, because I think a lot of people, they talk about the voting irregularities, you know, whether there are or not, but it's almost like it's this 50-state problem. They're everywhere. And just, no, you have to look at 50 systems.
Right. And that's one of the first, for those who don't understand how our elections are put together, they will understandably assume that we have 50 different election systems. I only wish that was true. We have closer to 5,000 different election systems. And the reason for that is in most states, with my home state of Rhode Island and I believe Delaware being the two oddballs here, most states take the responsibility for the conduct of elections and they move it to the county level of government to implement. And in some states, different counties purchase different election systems. Sometimes they have different processes that the counties follow so that the voting by mail can actually be somewhat different between two different counties in the same state. And these state-to-state differences and county-to-county differences yield some really surprising problems. I call them problems because a vote cast with the same set of circumstances can have a different outcome in some of these different places, which is outrageous to me. And the one of the clearest ways to just talk about this and describe it is to discuss what happens when somebody votes by mail but then dies before election day. Does the vote count or does it not count? And the answer is it depends. In a third of the states, there's a law that says the vote counts in that circumstance. In a third of the states, there's a different law that says the vote doesn't count. And then in the other third, there's no law that considers the situation at all. So how can we have such an uneven treatment of a vote with the same set of facts and the circumstances and how it was cast lead to a different result? Yeah. And it's not a small problem because in Michigan, a state that disallows the vote, in 2020, they disallowed 3,500 votes of voters who voted early and then had the misfortune of dying before the election. Now, that's just one example of a whole slew of different things, and particularly mail ballots. The state-by-state and county-to-county variabilities in how who qualifies to vote by mail, how much time do they have to cast that vote, what information is tracked as the request for the mail ballot is made to the delivery of the actual ballot to be filled out, to counting the ballot. There's all these steps in the middle, and some counties track it very clearly. Other counties don't. How they report the results and how they keep track of here's what went wrong and why, it varies all over the place. And to me, what all of this screams out for is federal oversight. Congress can pass laws that put frameworks around how we conduct our elections, and they have done so many times in the past. And I argue that we really need some more federal guidelines to help take some of these irregularities, get them out of the way so that the result is the same. And for people like me who look at voter data, it's a very frustrating thing to do, because while some of the biggest states in the country provide that data for free or near free, there are states like Alabama that charge $37,000 for their data. And in Massachusetts, nobody can get their data. So how can we talk about transparent?
Well, don't ignore Illinois. That's my home state.
Right. And Illinois actually makes it impossible to get at their data as well.
Thank you. I didn't want you to forget it.
So, I won't. And Indiana, by the way, Indiana, New Hampshire. I mean, you know, there's eight states where those states will not make available their voter database.
Which doesn't mean anything crooked's going on.
You hope not, but it's hard to know because of the non-transparency of how they're handling their data. And frankly, I think that there should be a federal law passed that says if you've taken any federal monies to help conduct your elections, you must share this data and you must provide it.
Let me just follow up a couple things. What is the theory for a state like Illinois? I thought Illinois allowed you to get to it. It's just lots of fees and things like that. I can understand the fee piece of it, right? Because there's an effort to get it together. What would a state fear by saying, we're not going to let you look at it?
I don't know, but Maine has been garbled up in a court case for 4 years trying to protect the privacy of their voter data and disallow anybody to look at it.
That's it. Is it about if you get voter data, are you seeing names and social security numbers? Are you seeing
not socials, but names and addresses and ages and dates of birth, which are important pieces that you need to help assess who's on the voter rolls.
Yeah.
And the National Voter, the National Voting Rights Act of 1992 has a clause that says that anybody can ask any state for their data for the purposes of evaluating the rolls.
How long does it take you when you asked to, like here, you were brought in to look at five key states, Arizona, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Wisconsin. How long did it take you to get that data? Was it a quick request or did the campaign have that data for you to look at?
So one of the reasons I took the job in the first place was I knew two key things that were necessary to do this work would be available. One was financial resources. It's not cheap to do the work that we were asked to do, and it required outside data vendors with very expensive analytics to do some of the behind the scenes work of what we needed to do. And the other thing was the data collection resources of the Republican National Committee, who had immediate access to the results from every election in every state and county because they have a gigantic network of people whose job it is to get that information and get it all into one big database. And so literally the day after the election, having access to data was not the problem. It was much more of a challenge dealing with, especially in states like Nevada, where the data we were being given was different for each of the counties who supplied it. And so we didn't have one job to look at the Nevada data. We had 17 different jobs. And when you only have 30 or 35 days to do a large project like this, that kind of a problem is an unwelcome one for sure.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's great, like I said, the fact that you do walk through pretty much the 50 states, as far as I recall, I mean, walking through everything. And like I said, I looked for my state, there it was, with your criticism there. So I think that's another reason people should check the book out, because it's not all about Trump. In fact, it's not only not all about Trump, but you write in the book about the necessity of speaking out about other elections. Carrie Lake, for example, who you talk about, who lost in her election. But you go on to make the point, but let's remember that the Republican treasurer in Arizona, that same state, won for election. So this argument that it was all about going after Trump and it was a fix, the fix was in for Trump. But you make the point, so many other Republicans went on to victory. So why would you elect so many Republicans if the Democrats were going to do a good job of controlling things, then wipe a lot of them out? Although I think an argument maybe from the other side, putting my lawyer head on, would be, well, maybe that's how you make it work. You don't go after everybody. That looks too crooked. So let's let some Republicans win.
Well, so I do have so about how I wrote the book. I think it's really, really important for your listeners to understand.
And viewers, we can see it.
And, it was not written as an anti-Trump book. It's facts. It's the facts of the claims of fraud I was asked to look at. It's the facts about how our election system needs to be made better in a lot of different ways. It's about here are the challenges to actually contesting an election result. And then what this piece, and I want to spin back to Carrie Lake and your suggestion that maybe some really smart bad guys figured out how to ensure Trump lost, but make sure some down ticket Republicans won. So I have a section of the book that did a county by county analysis of the entire country and compared the results in 2020 to the results in 2016. And what I looked at was Trump's share of the vote that he won in 2020 relative to 2016. Okay, so did he do better as a percentage of the vote or less? And what's phenomenal here and important for everybody to understand, there's a national trend in almost every state, including the reddest states. Trump, on average, did about 2.5% less well in 2020 than he did in 2016. That's state-level analytics. Almost across the board, that can't possibly be fraud. Nobody is that good to have committed national-scale voter fraud and delivered a 2.5% swing, right? It's not credible. But then when you look at the county-level statistics in the swing states, and I'm going to pick on Georgia because Georgia is the starkest example of this. Mm-hmm. Trump needed 12,000 votes to win in Georgia. And when you look at just the red counties, counties that voted for Trump in 16 and also in 20, and you see that in almost every single Georgia red county, Trump did less well in 2020 than he did in 2016, including some of the smallest counties in the state. That's not voter fraud. But what it is something that Trump's own pollster told him in December of 2020. And that report is on the web. It can be found on the politico.com website. And what his pollster told him is that effectively, I'm paraphrasing here, but the rhinos left him. And it makes sense that the rhinos left him because he pretty much took the rhinos and launched them into orbit. So nobody should be surprised that moderate Republicans either just didn't vote for president, and that happened. They voted for down-ticket Republicans but didn't vote for president. Or in an even more harmful vote, actually cast a vote for Biden instead. So, and that happened. And if had Trump kept the rhinos in the tent, he would still be president right now. I'm confident of that.
Interesting. Trump makes a big deal about the voter fraud, mail voter fraud and all of that. And, you know, of course, that's such a tough point for Republicans because everybody knows that they would do better, actually, if they supported massive vote by mail. But my question for you is, you actually raise this question in the book. You say, can the claim by Trump's people of massive mail fraud, can it be disproven? You write that it actually can't be. And your chapter on that, you even write, I think you wrote it in the book, or I found it in material about you, but you said that chapter almost didn't make it into the book. Why was that? Why wouldn't you want to put that chapter in the book? Ultimately, you do address it.
Yeah, I mean, well, I didn't, I almost wasn't just going to try to write the chapter because I knew, based on what I had to struggle with when I did the work in November of 2020, that it was that the quality of the data and what you really needed to be able to determine whether mail ballot fraud was happening or not, that it largely wasn't there when I looked at the swing states. And I was right. It wasn't there when I looked also at a national level in 2023. But it's – and what I mean by I can't disprove it, what I mean is that in the same way that I could show you – and I just described to you how there was a 2.5% decrease in performance on the part of President Trump in 2020 relative to 2016. I wanted to be able to show some quantifications of either the Democratic improvements in there or something. I wanted to be able to quantify some trends in that data. And I just couldn't because so much of the mail ballot data that's available on across the country, it doesn't even tell you break down the mail ballot votes in terms of Democrat versus Republican votes for president and that kind of thing. That level of detail isn't being maintained almost anywhere. There's only five states that give you that. So without that, I couldn't begin to address any questions about did mail ballot really impact Democrats? And if so, how? And I wanted to be able to quantify it and talk about it and get into it. And I was wholly unable to. But what's even more important to that is for anybody who claims that there is voter fraud in mail ballots, that mail ballot fraud is a thing and it caused the loss and everything else, because I can't disprove it, that also means nobody can possibly prove it. And that's really at the core of all of this.
Tied to the mail ballot, would part of, if somebody was in alleged fraud, here's one thing I think a lot of our viewers and listeners didn't know, I didn't know it before your book, which was, in some states, if you vote early and you die before election day, your vote's not supposed to count. Would one possibility be that they didn't get to those votes for death record rolls or whatever it is? And maybe part of the quote unquote fraud is that people who died before election day were those ballots were counted. And by the way, if the whole idea of not counting a vote because you die before election day, I'm not sure why that would even be, then maybe we should pull your vote if you vote on election day and die before we announce the results.
Yeah. So Pennsylvania does a terrible job at identifying registrants on their voter rolls who are dead. And I literally helped inform a court case that challenged them on it. And they settled the case and ultimately removed close to 20,000 registrants. So I do know a lot about identifying deceased voters and how that all works. Ahead of the 2020 election, I identified a voter in Pennsylvania who was registered in September of 2020, who had been dead since 2013. I saw that and I said, watch, this will become a fraudulent vote. It did. And that that foretelling was made in a court case in the middle of October of 2020. It's on the record. Election officials in Pennsylvania knew that this was a voter of concern, at least as far as I was concerned. They didn't do anything. The vote happened. After the vote was cast and counted, they eventually removed the voter from the rolls, arrested somebody for having conducted a fraudulent vote, prosecuted and convicted, and they wrapped the whole thing up.
Was it a family member or something like that? I mean,
it was a family member. There were several different examples of family members in Pennsylvania who resurrected a relative and cast a vote in there.
And was the vote a Trump vote or a Biden vote? Do you know?
In both cases in Pennsylvania where there were convictions, the person who perpetrated the crime admitted that it was a vote for Trump.
So, I mean, if anything, it was healthy. Trump would want those votes to be included.
If you're against voter fraud, you got to be against it all the way.
Yeah, well, I know, unless you got a point of view. But all right, so finally, the third part of your book, we have just a couple minutes left, The Principles for Change. And who can argue with the fact that you say elections have to be free and fair and transparent and impartial? But the question is, how do you do that, Ken? And you basically say you want every state essentially to follow the same procedures and handle things the same way. I guess that makes sense.
It really does make sense. What we're doing made sense 100 years ago. It doesn't make sense today. We still have states who, when you check in to vote in person, look you up in a thick pile of paper, and then they peel a sticker off and they have to attach a sticker next to your name, the proper name, to indicate that you arrived and cast your vote. That's a very error-prone solution to things. We allow gerrymandering. It's legal here, and it's amazing to me. We consider ourselves a foremost democracy in the world, but yet we allow partisan elected officials to draw maps that disadvantage their opponents.
And that's the problem. That's where politics gets in the way of this. I'm going to have to wrap us now, and I apologize for that. The book is Disproven by Ken Block, available at better bookstores everywhere and also online. Ken, congratulations on this. I mean, it's an important work, but it's not just about the 2020 election. People need to look back on this in the future for more information we get for future situations. I thank you for writing it, and I thank you for the research and your time with me today and on television.
Paul, thank you so much.
Appreciate you, Ken. Thank you.